The case for argument this morning is United States against Sandoval and others. Ms. Christensen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent one of the appellants, Annette Sandoval, in this matter. We're going to argue in the order that the cases are listed by number, in case the Court was wondering. Regarding Ms. Sandoval's argument, we're not arguing that the enhancement for the number of victims doesn't apply. We're not arguing that the district court failed to make findings about whether it factually applied. What we're arguing is that the district court failed to make findings or rulings regarding the disagreeing with policy reasons for the enhancement, which the court is allowed to do under Kimbrough.
Judge Kaur treated your argument as to the revised definition of a victim as a 3553 argument. So that he should be sentencing her as if he were applying the old definition. So doesn't that really make it absolutely clear that he understood his authority under Kimbrough?
I don't think it's as clear. And we're acknowledging this was under a 3553 analysis because reading the guidelines, the enhancement applies. We can't challenge that. And I believe that he considered it under the guidelines, but not all the policy reasons for disagreeing, the possible policy reasons for disagreeing, quite a few of which were pointed out by defense counsel in briefing and at sentencing hearing. Such as, you know, the victims are generally defined as people who experience an actual loss. That's the general definition of a victim, and the victims that we're talking about in this case don't apply under that. The tension in the guidelines created by the change in the commentary regarding victims. This is the only type of case where this changes the type of victims. In every other case, for people who do not experience a pecuniary harm, they are not considered victims.
But let's talk about Judge Kaur, because that's why we're here. And, he gave her somewhat of a break on top of everything. He sentences her to the low end of the new range, which overlaps with the high end of the old range.
Correct.
I mean, I think she did just fine under all the circumstances.
With all due respect, Your Honor, she did get a low-end, and he said the only comment he seemed to make is, I understand there's been a change in the guidelines, and I'm giving you a break for that. It's unclear whether he meant, otherwise I would have sentenced you to the high end.
How much do you feel these district judges have to say?
I think
I'm asking you that because I'm going back down to try some cases.
Well, good luck, Your Honor.
I need help.
Well, from our perspective, certainly from the defense perspective, when an issue is brought to light, as it was in this case, and this is very well litigated, not by myself in the district court, but very well litigated, that those issues should be addressed in some depth. I agree that there are times when an issue is simply thrown out there, a couple sentences are said, and perhaps an in-kind response by the judge is fine. But in a case like this, with an enhancement that had just changed, 6 weeks before sentencing, I do believe that more is needed than I'm giving you some credit for that. It really is not clear from the transcript that is cited, the portion is cited in our brief, that the judge considered these arguments, that are very substantial arguments. If she had merely been sentenced, as we know, 6 weeks before, she would have gotten a lower sentence, most likely. I see that I'm into my time, and I'm going to let my co-counsel take over from here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Saltzman.
May it please the court. This appeal is not about a sentencing decision in which the I's weren't dotted and the T's weren't crossed. It's about a sentencing hearing in which there was an arbitrary, one-sided commentary on the evidence, a real failure to consider almost all of the issues under 3553A that would have supported a much lower sentence. Three things mattered. the guideline offense level.
Mr. Saltzman, has this court ever held that a below-guideline sentence was nonetheless unreasonably high?
No, Judge, but my argument goes to the...
Why do you think we should be the first?
Because I think here the procedural question predominates, Judge, and that procedural question is were the issues raised?
To make a longer statement, do you really want this to go back to a different judge? It won't go back to Judge Kaur, who has retired. You want to go back to a different judge who, after fresh consideration, may decide that your client deserves a sentence within the guidelines?
Judge,
that sure could happen.
I don't believe so, Judge. In this case, you can believe anything you want,
but that could happen.
Judge, in this case, the government asked for a 30-month sentence on the basis of her cooperation. What was ignored was the dramatic changes in her life that were incredibly positive. The case was a one...
Mr. Saltzman, as I understand it, Judge Kaur actually recessed the sentencing in order to contemplate the arguments that Ms. Hicks was making. Doesn't that indicate to you that the man was really thinking about this carefully?
Judge, if I may, he recessed on one issue, and that is the extraordinary family circumstances, the needs of her children. He did recess and think about it, but it was an all or nothing. It was either home confinement or the 40 months that he gave her. He did not deal with the incredible post-offense rehabilitation that she had made. That issue was focused simply on an old criminal history. He talked about her change. The quote is, Judge, I don't feel any reason to relieve a defendant of a defendant's criminal past, no matter what they say about having seen the light and promise they're not going to do it anymore. That's a badge, and a defendant should be saddled with the consequences of a prior criminal behavior.
You know, she was not his first defendant.
That's right. Absolutely, Judge. But here, she had made this incredible transformation that these letters in the PSI really point out, and that was ignored, Judge. Her relative role in the offense compared to other people was ignored. Judge Kaur did not ignore the issues with her children. He clearly gave that consideration. But as I said, in the end, it was an all or nothing. So, Judge, I'd ask to reserve my remaining time.
And Mr. Saltzman? Mr. Grantham.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Matt Grantham, and I'm representing Sean Vanderhack in this appeal. We are asking the court to reverse and remand for resentencing because we believe that as a matter of law, the sentencing guideline 3C1.1, authorizing a two-point enhancement for obstruction of justice, was not appropriately applied in this case.
Is it your position that it would be error to apply that obstruction enhancement, even if it was his intent to persuade Mr. Schweiger to testify differently, or does his intent matter in your view?
I believe his intent definitely matters. I just don't believe that on these facts. I think there's agreement in the facts, but I don't believe that there's enough here to support a finding of specific intent to obstruct.
So, you know, we have to look at this as clear error, right? Yeah, right.
The facts are established, but yes, the standard of review applies in applying the sentencing guidelines.
Right. So, you know, given the context here, you know, including the fact that he tried to explain away his presence at their home, I mean, isn't it a fair inference that what he meant to do is to get one or both of them, the Schweigers, to change their testimony?
That's where I believe the government did not meet its burden to show the enhancement, Your Honor.
What about the fact that his pretrial release order prohibited contact with any witnesses? Does that suggest to you that his contact with the Schweigers might have been some sort of an attempted obstruction?
Not necessarily. It suggests to me that he violated his pretrial release order.
Well, when you violate your pretrial release order, you get punished.
There should be some consequences, but not necessarily under 3C1, Section 1.
Well, and that's what should the consequences be? What should the consequences be?
That could possibly be up to the district court judge upon remand, I would say.
No, give me some idea of a consequence. Naughty boy. I mean, what should the consequence be for this kind of behavior?
Well,
do you
to be
know
honest,
how terrifying it is to a witness to have the defendant come up and
I'm not sure how
look
terrifying.
In the eye? You not?
I'm not sure how terrifying it would be, honestly, since there's no. I mean, one witness testified to being uncomfortable. The other one said, I felt sorry for him. But with regard to what the punishment would be.
These Schweigers are just my idea of heroes, I have to tell you.
I understand. But with regard to what the punishment should be, I think perhaps the more appropriate thing to do would be simply to, at that point, we were at trial, we weren't at sentencing yet, revoke his pretrial release. He did violate the order. I would agree with that. Revoke his pretrial release, but I don't think that under the guidelines that necessarily means he obstructed justice. There's lots of reasons why people might contact witnesses, some for obstructive intent, sometimes just being stupid, as the defense attorney at trial suggested.
Well, the fact that there are innocent explanations for his behavior doesn't foreclose the guilty ones. And the district judge was entitled to draw the guilty inference here that he was trying to influence the testimony of these witnesses, or at least the remaining witness in the afternoon.
It doesn't foreclose.
There doesn't seem to be any other reason, you know,
other than sheer stupidity, Your Honor.
Stupidity. Yeah, that may be an innocent explanation that it was a bit, you know, bad judgment, etc. But you know, under the circumstances here, we've got a defendant charged with a white-collar crime. That means, you know, accepting the verdict, which we are at this point, obviously, he's a con man, right? And so
he is convicted of fraud, yes.
Trying to con these victims into changing their testimony by ingratiating himself with them.
Based on the
That's
evidence.
That's a very plausible inference.
Based on the evidence presented, I think the only inference there is that he was stating that he had another version of events. He could well have gone into the courtroom and told that exact same version of events. Thank you. Unless there are other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grantham. Mr. McFadden.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. I'll take the defendants in order as well. In Defendant Sandoval's case, the judge applied the 2009 version of the guidelines. That expanded the definition of a victim in fraud cases from people who suffered out-of-pocket losses to also people who were the victims of identity theft. And that bumped the number of victims up from 40 up to 65. That resulted in a 4-level enhancement instead of a 2. The judge clearly understood the argument being raised by Defendant Sandoval, and that was that he should have exercised his discretion under Kimbrough to vary from these new guidelines. And the judge gave policy-based reasons for following the new version of the guidelines. He said that the old view seemed to be the rule of no harm, no foul. And he said that that didn't seem to fit in this case because the only reason that certain victims did not suffer out-of-pocket loss is because either they were vigilant and they noticed the unauthorized use of their credit cards, or the credit card issuers and the merchants noticed the unauthorized use and they stopped the shipment of the packages before they could get out of the warehouse and before they could be stolen. So the judge rejected, on policy grounds, the old view of no harm, no foul. The judge also pointed out that our economy is increasingly a credit-based economy. It's not a cash-based economy. So when somebody like the defendant steals the names and credit card numbers from dozens of people and then uses them to make hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of orders on those credit cards, that's the type of thing that warrants a stiff sentence, and it warrants applying this version of the guidelines which Congress and the Sentencing Commission had put together. So I do think the judge engaged the defendant on the issues that we raised, and I believe her sentence should be affirmed. Also, for the reasons, as you pointed out, he went to the low end of the range, as we suggested, and I believe that that accounted for any equities that might have been in Sandoval's favor. Second, as for Defendant Vanderhack, it's clear in this circuit.
Hicks is next.
Oh, you're right. April Hicks had 17 adult convictions between 1991 and 2007.
So then what was the basis for your recommendation that she be sentenced to 30 months?
I think that that's been it's been a little bit overstated. I don't know if I made that as a recommendation. The judge was asking me, what did some of the cooperators get? And I said they got between 33% and 50% off. I said that in her case, I said a 30-month sentence, that might be a good sentence in this case, given that she has made some progress in her life and that she did provide some cooperation. I do want to point out that her cooperation was not on par with the defendants who got additional cooperation, because there was a long stretch of time between when she was indicted up until about a month before the Vanderhack trial when she did not cooperate with us at all. So the judge gave her the equivalent of 20% off of her guideline range, which was less than what the cooperators got who were on board throughout the entire case. I think in terms of did the judge consider all of the arguments in this case, he heard what I had to say and he heard what Mr. Saltzman had to say, and the judge still came up with a 40-month sentence. I think that shows that he did look at the totality of the circumstances. And it also is significant, I think, that he took the unusual step of recessing for 2 days in order to expressly, as he said on the record, he was agonized over how could he give her a sentence that she deserved and yet also account for the needs of her children and minimize the burden on her children. I think the judge did exactly what he was supposed to do in this case, and that was to respond to the arguments, think about them. He didn't have to accept them, but he did consider them. And so I believe that he reached a reasonable sentence under 3553.
What was the nature of the 17 priors?
A lot of them were retail theft type things. I think there might have been a couple drug offenses, but there were things like shoplifting
from
stores.
She was a serial shoplifter.
That's correct. She had multiple convictions for that. And one of the arguments was maybe the shoplifting is related to a drug addiction. The judge just didn't find that argument persuasive. There was a stretch of time in her life when she said that she was using drugs. During that time, she also had a lot of convictions. But the judge's point was they don't have to be related. Maybe I would see more of a relationship, the judge said, if she were stealing things in order to make money to then sell those things to support a drug habit. But they were a lot of petty-type thefts. They were for things like over-the-counter medications or shirts at Walmart, things like that.
So all misdemeanors, or were there any felonies?
There were felonies in there. I know for one of them she got, I believe, 3 years in IDOC.
A felony retail theft or a felony of a different sort?
I believe it was a felony because it was a 3-year sentence. I don't know how it
could
have
been. But a felony retail theft, not a felony, some other kind of crime.
Correct. I'm 90% sure on that, Judge, but I believe that's what it was. I believe there are felony retail thefts in there. There also were some obstruction of justice counts. One of the obstruction of justices was in state court. While this fraud scheme was going on, she was stopped by a local police officer. She gave a false name, and so she got an obstruction count while this very offense was going on. It was unrelated to this offense, but she picked up another conviction as this was going on. The last defendant is Defendant Vanderhack, and it's clear under the guidelines that obstruction can include unlawfully influencing or attempting to unlawfully influence the testimony of a witness. And in this case, I think you're familiar from the facts from the questioning.
Well, tell me this. Does his intent in approaching the Schweigers matter? Like, what if Judge Corr had found that he really was just maintaining his innocence without, you know, any intent to influence them? Would he still qualify for the enhancement?
No. Intent does matter. And we do have a factual finding here that there was the intent to obstruct. The argument raised was the same argument raised in front of you, that the defendant was acting stupidly but not necessarily intending to obstruct. And the judge's response was, a lot of defendants do things that are not that bright, but I can't conceive a reason why he would go up to some witnesses before they're going to testify unless, at minimum, he intended to influence their testimony. So it would be a different case without that finding, Judge, but we do have it, and it's entitled to deference under the clear error standard of review. Unless there are any questions for me, reserve my time. I'm not going to reserve my time, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McFadden.
Reserve it for the next case.
Okay. Thank you.
We do not in the Seventh Circuit offer rollover minutes.
Now I learned this.
Ms. Christensen. Mr. Saltzman.
Shoplifting cases, charges end in 2002. She has one giving false identification information to a police officer in 2007. She's sentenced in 2008. She totally transforms her life. That's ignored by the district court because she has a badge. This is a case where an under-guideline sentence was unreasonable. The government said 30 for cooperation. She'd made all these changes in her life, none of which she got credit for, and there were the family, and there were the real issues for her family that the judge considered, but really as an all-or-nothing basis. I'd welcome an opportunity to have her resentenced in front of another judge and make these arguments. I think they will be successful.
You must be kidding.
No, Judge.
You have no idea of what we have seen up here.
Judge,
we have pleaded with lawyers. I'm taking some of your time, but I'm going to just say it. We have pleaded with lawyers saying, do you realize what could happen? And believe me, it has.
Judge, I appreciate that, and I make those kinds of determinations.
I
make those kind of determinations.
I'm looking for your next case.
But it's coming up. But in this situation, Judge, in this situation, given all that this woman had, and in the cooperation, she wore a wire, she told them about a delivery, she testified at trial, her cooperation was significant. It's true there was a little period of time when there wasn't cooperation, but that was the when there wasn't a trial.
A month before trial?
She was asked to testify and came in and cooperated. Judge, she wore a wire in the investigation against Ms. Sandoval. She told them about a package that was being delivered so they could be there to intercept it. She did a lot in terms of cooperation, but she made these incredible changes in her life that Pepper tells us need to be considered.
She's still lying to the police about what her real name is?
In 2007, before this case, Judge, there's nothing after that. And the drug, her use of drugs, is very consistent with all of these cases. All of those prior charges. After that, she changes her life. She goes to school to be a drug counselor. She works for a disabled person. She's a great mother for her children. Those are the things that the court didn't consider. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The cases are taken under advisement.